So whether it's the Back to the Future series, which is tremendous from Steven Spielberg, or movies like Pleasantville, which really brought two now sort of famous Hollywood actors onto the screen in pivotal roles, Reese Witherspoon and the future Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire, the 1950s, from the perspective of Hollywood in our own lifetimes, is often dramatized. It's often depicted as a period of conformity, right? A period in which, especially in the movie Pleasantville, which is in it's half black and white and half color, the 1950s is seen as a period of black and white. That is, say, a time in American history where conformity and uniformity were seen as values, and that thinking outside of the box or being creative, being countercultural, was simply not accepted. But in truth, a real examination and an accurate examination of that decade, the 1950s, requires us to analyze and come to an understanding and comprehension that it was a period of great cultural flourishing and ideological exchange. It is a period, as I think the text writers, Murren et al., did an amazing job in presenting to you, especially toward the end of that chapter, of great economic, social, cultural, and political debate and discourse. As much as the question has been posed to me in the past, mainly by you guys, as we've studied American history, where is it or what is the point in American history in which we see developing the current political divide between right and left? And frankly, while there are a lot of commentators, especially European historians today, but also American social and political commentators, talking about how that divide left and right isn't so useful, some are arguing that those distinctions are dead today. I think it is useful. There are ideological principles that are either shared by those on the right of the political spectrum, I was doing your right, or the left of the political spectrum. I'll just use my own perspective here. Okay? And in large part, the debate that arose about what the path or trajectory that the United States should take emerging within the early Cold War, well, those principles, those positions are really firmed up, concretized, if you will, in the 1950s. And I had argued in the past that it was the progressive era that set the stage for that. I think in the 1950s, with figures ranging from Barry Goldwater on one side and on the other side, John Kenneth Galbraith and John Maynard Keynes and Keynesians, Hayek going on more on this side, being the foe of Keynes, economically and ideologically speaking, the 50s are actually a fascinating time of lurid colors and distinctions, especially given the fact that, yes, there was a consensus, an American consensus about middle-class values, religiosity, in a sense, diversity of opinion, right? But as long as that diversity of opinion flowed in one direction, in a weird way, as you read, there was an emerging counterculture that didn't just start and didn't have its conception in the 1960s. It had started to emerge in the 1950s, which was a rejection, that counterculture, a rejection of some of the things that were seen as conformist, consumerism, middle-class values, general popular religiosity. Okay, so we're going to examine that a bit more today. Beyond that, just on an administrative note, notice I'm not going to go over the test. The reason I'm not going to go over the test is that, unlike previous exams, we don't have time to do so. And beyond that, I'm just going to give you through email all the correct answers so you can take a look at those that you erred on or those that you got right, right? And the reason I haven't done so thus far, even though your scores have appeared on Schoology, is because Maria and Jacqueline haven't taken that exam. So it would be kind of counterproductive of me to give you all the answers before they took the exam, right? It certainly wouldn't be fair to you, those of you who are here, to take the exam on the appropriate day. So allow me to bring up some notes on the 1950s after that general commentary. And what I referred to earlier about the last section of the reading that you had for today, I thought that was a brilliant encapsulation and summary of the debate that still rages between those who are advocates on the right of smaller, unintrusive government, but yet a government that would facilitate either the containment of communism where it existed, or actually, as John Foster Dulles and Avery Dulles wanted, a rollback of communism, right? And on the left side of the political spectrum, seeing government again as activists. So it would be the progressive New Dealer faction of either the fringe Republican liberal part of the party, or more so the Democratic Party. And also we have to take note that the 1950s featured, in terms of the political spectrum, there were rabidly conservative, even Dixiecrat segregationist Democrats. And then there were the more progressive wing of the New Dealing sort of Woodrow Wilsonite Democrats, all within one party, advancing toward the same aims of defeating Republicans in elections. Conversely, there was emerging within the Republican Party some Northeastern Republicans who tended to be much more liberal in their outlooks. The Rockefeller family, for example, became quite Republican, but they were more liberal Republican in nature. Lincoln Chafee eventually becomes, especially in the 1970s and 80s, a political force in Rhode Island, but he's essentially what we call a RINO today. Does anyone know what RINO stands for? Republican in name only. If you take that acronym, Republican in name only, it means RINO without the H, okay? Did that just dawn on you, Paul? Is that what the reference was? Oh, what the heck? Democrat in name only would be DINOS. I wonder if anyone's ever used that. You could trademark it, Cedar Roth. Trademark it. Who would be a Democrat in name only today? Maybe Joe Manchin of West Virginia, right? Have a very conservative, blue-collar, mining state. He has to, as a Democrat, really show himself to be quite conservative. And so the Elizabeth Warrens or even Bernie Sanders of the Democratic Party today might determine that Joe Manchin is a dino or a Democrat in name only. For example, even Joe Manchin just voted for, along with Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat from North Dakota, for the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. So he's taking a different tack, to be sure. And why does Joe Manchin do that? Because he wants to be reelected, right? Because he wants to be reelected. In a sense, therefore, the very Manchin senatorial term and the Heitkamp senatorial term from North Dakota are just confirmation of that the Constitution works in many ways, right? That ambition has to check ambition, and that if you want to be reelected, you have to defy party lines at times or party stances, and that's certainly the case with the Gorsuch nomination and confirmation. Okay, so thanks to your reading as well as your viewing of Pappy Days, right? Of course, Days with the D-A-Z-E, little pun there because of the famous Happy Days. Everybody realized that's what was going on. Does everyone know what Happy Days as a sitcom was? Okay, very good. I have to check because... right? Unless you're watching Nickelodeon or Nick at Night or like TV Land, you might not know what Happy Days is, right? Haley, you're saying you don't know what Happy Days is? Okay, so who wants to explain what Happy Days as a sitcom was? You just nodded and said you knew what Happy Days as a sitcom was, and now you're saying no. You don't know. Okay, so this is time to tell the truth, okay? Not for the purpose of me maligning you, but for the purpose of me understanding what you know and what you don't know. You know of it. Okay, what? If you know of it, what do you know about it? That is a TV show. Okay, what decade did it chronicle or situate itself in? The 1950s, right? And it featured several different characters. It was actually created in the 1970s. And early 80s, it featured Ron Howard, the famous director. And he played, he was a member of the Cunningham family. And the Cunningham family was this Joni Cunningham. Richie Cunningham was the boy who Ron Howard played. This idyllic American 1950s middle class family, right? And of course, the countercultural character was Arthur Fonzarelli, also known as the Fonz, right? And the Fonz rode a motorcycle. He was a rebel. He was sort of the James Dean character. And the James Dean character was the Rebel Without a Cause famous movie in the 1950s, which was countercultural. which was a rejection of the prevailing social and cultural attitudes of the day, conformity, consumerism, and the like. Okay, so the film you saw was the part of the Century series was a pun on that, Happy Days, right? And rather than seeing viewing the 1950s as this idyllic time of economic expansion, of shared cultural and political values, stability at home, the emergence of the strong American middle class, the film characterized the idea that, or actually presented the idea that the decade was tumultuous, that there was not agreement necessarily, or that if there was agreement and a general cultural shared system of values, there was an emergence soon to be coming or down the road or on the horizon that there would be division within the United States, right? Okay, and that's the 1960s. So how to characterize the Eisenhower years further? A lot of this is going to be highlighting what you read or providing some further analysis and extrapolating from what you've already come to know about the decade. Okay. So, some prevailing cultural and social changes. Broad concerns of developments more so, right? So a couple things here listed. First, what's the status of the United States? The general worldview of Americans, if there was one that existed in the country circa 1952. Well, broad concerns and developments included first, the end of the Korean War. By 1952, the United States had been engaged in warfare in one form, variety, or another since 1941, the end of 1941. As you could anticipate and certainly pick up from your reading, as well as the viewing of the Century series film, Americans were war weary, and rightfully so. From 1950 onward, the late summer of 1950, the United States made up the bulk of the UN forces fighting against North Korean communist forces, aided and abetted by Chinese communists and armed by the Soviet Union in Korea. The fact that 53,000 plus Americans died in the Korean War and body bags continued to come home after the end of World War II, from the perspective of Americans, well, it was draining their desire to combat communism to a degree, right? So war weariness set in, but that doesn't mean that Americans weren't looking for other methods and means by which to contain communism. It just, from the perspective of many Americans, was not going to be in a traditional warfare setting like that of World War II and the Korean War. Americans were going to look for alternative means by which to contain the threat of Soviet and, in this case, Chinese and North Korean communism. So in the 1952 campaign for the presidency, the Republican Party, more so Dwight David Eisenhower, who was the eventual nominee of the party for the presidency that year, promised that upon being elected as president, he would seek out an armistice or ceasefire within the Korean War. He even pledged his willingness to go over to Korea, something that presidents didn't generally do, right? I mean, the first American president to actually leave the country during his own presidency was Theodore Roosevelt, right? So Eisenhower actually pledged to go himself over to Korea and work out some sort of agreement with the North Korean communist regime so as to end the war and allow the stalemate that had been achieved at around the 38th parallel, you remember, in the demilitarized zone to exist as a permanent or semi-permanent solution to the Korean conflict and crisis. How long has that existed? Exists to this day. I mean, we just had the Vice President of the United States just last week visiting the demilitarized zone and visiting with American troops there, and unfortunately pledging that the Trump administration is not, it's not out of the realm of possibility that military force might be used against the North Koreans and the North Korean regime there. From my perspective, that's a terrible misunderstanding of what North Korea exists as today. North Korea and the North Korean regime feeds off of such controversy. It is a process of legitimizing itself to its own people by saying that the West, that South Korea, that the world is allied against this hermit kingdom. And so that only reinforces the necessity or presumed necessity of the communist regime there, and further legitimizes the suppression of civil rights and liberties by that regime. Okay, so anyway, keep that in mind as we're talking about the aftermath of the Korean War. After the end with Korea, other concerns and developments included trying to halt the spread of communism. Communism was viewed by, and legitimately so, most Americans as a subversive idea, anti-American in nature. Obviously, it was against capitalism, generally free market enterprise. Communism as a political system and ideology curtailed civil liberties. It argued for collectivization, that enterprises, businesses, institutions not only be run but maintained by the state in perpetuity. So, given that threat, it was seen as one that was both domestic and foreign, or I should say foreign and domestic in that order. So it should be no surprise then that HUAC, what does HUAC stand for? What does HUAC stand for? House Un-American Affairs Committee. Very good. Or for short, HUAC, headed by, up to that point in the 1940s and 50s, not an altogether household name, but one that would become one. A certain representative from California, Richard Nixon, would be the head of HUAC. And he was responsible, along with Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, for rooting out subversive, pro-communistic, even Soviet spies within the American government. Now, HUAC would eventually expand its mission to look at different institutions as well, including Hollywood, in the intelligentsia, those who are working in universities, the educated, government itself, but also labor unions. Remember that as part of the Taft-Hartley Act from the late 1940s, one of the stipulations of Taft-Hartley, which rolled back some of the privileges that unions had enjoyed in the progressive era and even in the Roosevelt administration, it required union leaders and even union members to take a non-communist oath. That was part of Taft-Hartley, right? So this is just an expansion of the program by which Reds were rooted out, or those who were pinko communist sympathizers. I was just watching Seinfeld. One of the things that I like to do is watch Seinfeld over and over again because there's just great wisdom in it. All right. And I'm on the very end of, I shouldn't say I watch over and over again, but I decided about a couple months ago that I watch the first episode all the way through the end. I'm on season 9 right now, and it's the episode, if you're familiar with Seinfeld, in which Jerry goes down to Florida where his parents live, and he just absolutely ridicules old senior citizen culture in Florida, and his parents like eat every meal at 4:30 for the early bird special because old people like to eat early. It's not fun. Do you know old people? Okay, elderly people, like, they drive slow. That's the other stereotype about them. I know you're not supposed to like stereotypes, but basically that's humor, right? Because you've been conditioned that's mean. It's mean to make fun of someone. This is why Seinfeld, for example, and even Chris Rock, they don't tour college campuses anymore because everyone's so offended by everything. That's a microaggression against old people. Shut up, all right? That's a real aggression. I'm telling you to shut up. That's a real aggression. It's not micro. I'm being aggressive toward you. It's a macro aggression. Thank you, Jack. A macro. We're going to trademark dino and macro aggression. I'm in favor of those. Macro aggression. Now I sound like a fascist, okay? So please, I'm not Mussolini. Put that one in the book. Now I sound like a fascist. Yes, okay. That should be that. Maybe that's the title. Now I sound like a fascist. The Ruminations of Mr. Richard on U.S. History. yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. I did record that, though, Jack. So those are in the running. Now I sound like a fascist. I actually like that one. Although I don't like fascism. So, I don't know. Okay. We got off the tracks there. just thinking about more ideas for the title, so now I'm obsessed with that. What was I talking about before that? Oh, Seinfeld. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Not that was like a tangent off a tangent. Anyway, so basically, Jerry's father becomes obsessed with his condo association's elections, right? And he decides that because he's been ousted from his previous condo association, like Nixon, right? He's going to create a puppet regime by having Kramer run as the new condo board president, right? And at one point, Jerry says, well, Dad, why didn't you just run? Why don't you just run for condo board president of Del Boca Vista Phase 2? Because everything has like a Spanish name in Florida. All right. So he goes, oh, my God, I couldn't run. And Mrs. Seinfeld, Jerry's mom, says, oh, yeah, the press would kill us if we tried to run again. And Jerry goes, what press? It's the Condo Board Association. And she goes, well, the Boca Breeze, for example. And he goes, you have a Condo Board Association newspaper? She says, yes, it's called the Boca Breeze. And then Mr. Seinfeld goes, pinko commie rag. He thinks it's communistic. That's why he shut them out. Anyway, pinko means pro-communist or like sort of leaning red. And McCarthyism was all about rooting out anyone who had such sympathies. A third major development, the Silent Revolution. This is something that's often overlooked, thus the name the Silent Revolution. But there is a rather dramatic shift as GIs come home from war, veterans from war who had participated in World War II or Korea, from blue to white collar work. What does it mean to be a blue collar worker versus a white collar worker? What is this collar revolution about? Okay, very good. So manual laborers, those in trades, are blue-collar workers. Plumbers, electricians, carpenters, factory workers along an assembly line, auto workers, those are all blue-collar jobs. Conversely, white-collar jobs, which tended to be the most attractive to people coming home and by which GIs were being aided and facilitated by the government to enter into by having their upper education or classes at colleges provided for them those type of jobs are doctors, lawyers, professionals. I'm glad you brought up advertising and marketing because that's the new, very attractive sector emerging within the American economy. Why is it so attractive? Because of consumerism and because of the economic boom. What does that facilitate and aid? It facilitates and aids the consumption of more and more materials, products that are being created by the American industrial complex, if you will. By the way, has anyone seen Mad Men? Why don't you watch television? What is wrong with you? What's that? Okay, Mad Men. I know there are a lot of choices, but there are good choices and there are bad choices. Mad Men is an excellent choice to watch. If you want an interesting commentary on mores in the 1950s and 60s. John Hamm plays Donald Driver, and Donald Driver is the prototypical, one might argue, 1950s advertising executive within that. And what's really cool about Mad Men, too, is because, get it, Mad Men, they're crazy, but they're ad men. They're advertising executives. Oh, okay, good. So two puns we got today, right? Happy Days and Mad Men. Right? What's really cool about Mad Men 2 is everything's period. That is to say, from the clothes that he wears, to the TV he watches, to the drinks he prefers, Southern Comfort, Old Fashions, that's actually my drink too, but they're all very period. The clothing is spectacular. The performances are even better. So I encourage you to watch that if you have time, which you don't because you're studying for a push in the exam. And doing your podcasts, remember your podcasts. Noah, don't look at me like you're confused about that. Okay, so you can look at me in a confused light in any other way, but not in that way. Okay, fourth thing, cultural trends that were emerging, and this was chronicled in the film. The creation of rock and roll. as a counter-cultural movement and musical genre in and of itself. Elvis, it's hard to describe. It's actually better if I say this. It's hard to overestimate Elvis and more generally rock and roll's impact in dividing the generations within the 1950s. There was among the youth a motivation to embrace Elvis as a countercultural figure. Here's a guy who, unlike the sort of big band groups that were preferred by the parents' generation of the 1950s, here's a guy who embraced African-American genres of music, blues, jazz, soul, and coupled it with country bluegrass and hillbilly music. He was from Biloxi, Mississippi, and created this entirely new musical genre in which he would perform on stage and his hips would gyrate in such a way that people were scandalized. Girls, as you saw in the film, young girls would go and scream. This is the birth of the boy band phenomenon. He's the boy, though. He's the guy. It's not a group. It's not NSYNC. It's not Backstreet Boys or One Direction. It's just Elvis up there, right? And he embodied going in a different direction than what your parents were telling you to do, right? And other rock and roll acts would do the same. Chuck Berry, Little Richard. These were both African-American men who were embraced by white youth culture for the different musical genre, something that was totally different than what their parents had listened to. Okay, so that's rock and roll. Later, of course, the British invasion would cause the Beatles to become household names in the late 50s and early 60s. Another major trend, consumerism, right? Advertising fueled Americans' desire, but I would also say this was born out of the social consciousness of keeping up with the Joneses, if you'll remember that cliche, of if someone down the street owned the most recent RCA television, there was an incredible social pressure placed upon families to keep up with that level of consumption. So the buying of new appliances, new technologies, maybe a second automobile. Furthermore, as we're going to discuss, the move out and away from urban environments into the burgeoning suburbs was a major trend as well. If you've ever seen suburban sprawl or look up just on Google suburban sprawl and just hit on images, you're going to see some really novel pictures and interesting pictures of brand new streets in cookie cutter house suburbs. You live in them now, not the cookie cutter houses, but in the same suburbs, right? Wherein you'll see just down a block, maybe 15 houses, and there'll be 10 moving vans, all from different companies, of people moving away from the city into these new suburbs. Keep in mind, the suburbs that many of you live in were founded pretty much at the turn of the century, maybe a little bit earlier. In the case of Riverside was founded in 1890, 1892. LaGrange, about the same time. Brookfield, a little bit later. I'm just talking about some area suburbs. Oak Park's a little bit older. But Oak Park doesn't become very populated, nor do the suburbs that we just rattled off, until the 1950s and 60s. And when in the future, maybe 10, 15 years from now, when you are looking for your first house as a young family and you go and look at Brookfield or LaGrange, what you're going to notice is that scattered throughout these suburbs, there are homes that were built at the turn of the century. Some of them, like in Brookfield, are even farmhouses that have been rehabbed. And every other house in between the farmhouses that are sporadically scattered throughout are pretty much houses that were raised branches built in the 1950s and 60s to accommodate the suburban sprawl. Good? So these are major demographic and cultural changes that are taking place right in the decade. Yes, Paul? Absolutely, yeah, that consumerism had been contained by the rationing of World War II. There's a great documentary about this. Interestingly enough, it was put out by Steve Bannon about, I want to say about 10 years ago, when he had just started to be involved with Breitbart. Steve Bannon is President Trump's chief advisor, right? Chief White House advisor, chief, I forget what the title is. Chief of staff? Is that it? Or is that Connell? What's that? Oh, that's Priebus. So, yeah, you're right. That's Ryan Priebus. Oh, awful name. He's national. No, he's on the national security team. Yeah, he was. He was out there. So he's basically an advisor, okay? And I forget his exact title, but he was, of course, very involved in the election process. And, of course, there's the recent thing about everyone's kind of divided in the Trump White House, how Bannon doesn't like Kushner and Ivanka's trying to smooth things over. It's like a soap opera. Okay, General Trump White House instead of General Hospital. Or as Trump's world turns, you know, something like that. But those are soap operas, by the way. I know you don't watch television, so I had to point that out. Yeah, Noah. Yeah, but before I address that, let me go back to what I started to address with Paul. So it was a documentary that came out. Bannon produced it. It was called Generation Zero. It was basically all about how millennials are screwed. We're screwed because of you. You were inculcated, not that it's your fault, but from Bannon's perspective, it's really the fault of parents of the baby boomer generation. So this would be my grandparents and your great-grandparents who screwed up your parents and my parents, okay? And why they screwed them up was because my grandparents' generation, your great-grandparents' generation had gone through, according to this thesis, had gone through the Great Depression and World War II. And if they survived those two events, they then didn't want their children to experience anything like that. And so there was a coddling effect going on in World War II, or in the post-World War II generation. So whereas the older generation had experienced these terrible, tumultuous events, the Great Depression, World War II, rationing, all that awfulness, they wanted to shield their children, their offspring, from such effects. And so they spoiled my parents' generation, maybe your parents' generation too. Okay? And what did that produce? A sense of entitlement from this film's perspective, a sense of entitlement that led to the welfare warfare state, that government has to do everything for us, because what coincided with them being spoiled was this incredible expenditure on of an expansion of government and the removal of, especially in minority communities, the father from the family. So who's going to take the place of the father within the family in the sexual revolution? Well, it's government is going to do that. And so we're coddled. And to an extent, I agree with the thesis. I mean, think about what happens when, forget the poor for a moment, what happens when there's a national emergency, Hurricane Katrina, right? But let's not even talk about Katrina for a moment, because that adversely affected a lot of poor people given where it hit. Let's talk about like something like Hurricane Andrew in the 1990s. Hurricane Andrew hit the Carolinas. I remember this very, very vividly. It was a very powerful hurricane. Well, most of the people's homes who were destroyed were these rich East Coast, Northeast Coast vacation homes along the sea. Because after all, the poor people and middle-class people who live in the Carolinas don't live along the shore. They live in the cities. They live in the suburbs. They don't live along those very, really expensive real estate portions of the Carolinas. Well, it came out in the 1990s. Of course, what did the very wealthy turn to when their vacation homes were destroyed? They didn't actually first call their insurance companies. They called the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. And FEMA provided these very low interest loans, sometimes even grants of monies, to already extremely wealthy people to rebuild their summer homes. So you had poor, middle class, even wealthy people who lived in Iowa, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Washington State, paying for people's summer homes to be rebuilt along the Carolina coast, where the answer should have been, screw you, don't build your house on stilts on a beach and expect the federal government to pay for it. That's the Cleveland answer, not Cleveland, Ohio. We know what Cleveland I'm talking about, right? Or that's the Coolidge answer, but it's not the answer today. Anyway, I kind of got on a soapbox there. So that's what that movie's about. Your question, Noah, is were people traumatized from war? Of course they were. to the extent that they were able to recover so quickly and lead generally healthy lives is in and of itself a kind of a phenomenon. But don't get the idea that veterans coming back from World War II were any less traumatized than those coming back from World War I or previous American war engagements or the Civil War or something like that. They were traumatized. One might argue what mitigated the problems or the aftermath, if there was a mitigation of those problems, because veterans suffered from alcoholism, World War II veterans. They suffered from trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. Combine those two things. Domestic abuse was present, if ultimately very underreported, right? So there was a significant trauma coming from that. And Korea, too. We shouldn't forget Korea as well, right? And then let's just expand that a bit, because nuclear tests are going off and soldiers were forcefully subjected to the downwind effects of some of those nuclear tests. Cancer was an enormous problem and the like. Okay, you had mentioned in the text about how the Hollywood crew of that film, The Contender, half of them contracted cancer because they were downwind, they didn't know it, from a nuclear test site in Utah. Right, so there are terrible effects from engagement in a perpetual war, which the Cold War was, emerging from World War II. Good. Any other questions before I continue on, or comments? Okay. Revolutionary, the television. Americans spent, given the availability of television in the 1950s, about one-third of their waking hours. It says working up there, that's a typo. Their waking hours in front of the television. That's amazing. And you saw in the Happy Days segment how the famous American playwright Neil Simon actually reported that he and his siblings would actually sit in front of the TV with just the salt and pepper screen going, because there wasn't a perpetual television going on and everything was essentially live at the time, right? You never knew, he said, when something might come on, so you just watched, right? You just watched. Another effect of that, well, a couple things there. Let's not ridicule people in the 1950s, because as much as they spent one-third of their waking hours in front of the television, how much time do we spend on Facebook? How much time do we spend on the socials, right? And that actually has impacted working hours. So there's perhaps a reason for the typo there. It's been done, several surveys have been done about how much time workers spend on their personal accounts, on their personal social accounts. And some of the hours are striking. Like one-third to one-half of the workday is just spent on your social accounts, whether it's through LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. And that's during where you're supposed to be working, right? So don't blame them so much by being fascinated by television. Well, the second thing, too, that wasn't really touched upon as much, and I think it needs to be stressed about television, is that what it created was, as much as the radio started this trend, television concretized it, a unifying national language, a unifying national set of values. Because through this medium, if you were an advertising exec on Fifth Avenue in New York, and you flew or took a train out to San Francisco on the same day, the water cooler talk or conversations around the water cooler could be exactly the same, because you were all watching I Love Lucy. You were all watching Howdy Doody. Well, the kids were at least. You were all watching these various programs, right? And you knew through the commercials that were featured of the different products that were being scattered across the country, right? You wanted to stay at a Holiday Inn. You wanted to test out this new fast food, whatever that is, restaurant from Kansas called McDonald's, right? So there was a shared consensus created by the television. Suburban sprawl, we already tackled. One after effect of that was the phenomenon of white flight. The vast majority of people moving out of their urban neighborhoods were European of Caucasian descent. And these were the ones who were populating the new suburbs. Note, this was in part as a result of the recent migrations, or relatively recent migrations, of African Americans to inner cities, particularly in the north. Remember, the first and second great migrations only occurred during World War I and World War II. So these larger minority communities were only being established, or still being established, by the time that GIs are coming home, right? So the African-American expansion of those neighborhoods would continue. African-Americans would spread from the traditional urban or African-American centers into more white neighborhoods, and that just further increased the spread of white flight from those areas. The perception that once African-Americans moved into a traditionally white neighborhood, that housing values would go down did become a reality for some, and they left those areas, okay, for the new suburbs. Good? Movement to the south and the west, the Sun Belt. Before, Arizona had this sort of cowboy tombstone idea or vision attached to it. California was kind of weird and out there, still kind of weird and out there. But Americans were drawn to the warmer weather in the Sun Belt, also further economic opportunities. Why were there further economic opportunities in the Sun Belt, California, Arizona, even places like Florida, Alabama, South Carolina? Well, maybe not so much Alabama. What's going on economically within the Sun Belt? Paul? Okay, right. Although those irrigation projects, often funded and subsidized by the government, right, would create and expand the amount of arable land, it doesn't necessarily mean that more workers are going to be hired. Migrant workers, yes. Okay, and immigrant workers, yes. But not so much those who are seeking positions, especially white collar and to an extent blue collar positions in those areas. A little bit with the film industry, not so much advertising, but more so that in the old manufacturing centers, the Cleveland, Ohio's, the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's, the Allentown, Pennsylvania's, the Chicago, Illinois's, the Milwaukee, Wisconsin's, right? What institution tended to dominate and dominate to such an extent that it didn't provide burgeoning economic opportunities for corporations? In other words, what institution was so powerful in those old areas of what's considered the Rust Belt today that prohibited companies from their perspective, making a good buck? No? Unions. Unions dominated to the extent that 35% of the industrial labor force was unionized in the 1950s. In the South, there were no unions or no operative and organized unions, and so corporations started moving there. We should also note the importance of air conditioning. Remember we said one of the primary reasons, hi Maria, one of the primary reasons, hi Jacqueline, that there wasn't an industrialization of the South or the West before was because it's too hot, especially in the South. Well, air conditioning takes care of that, does it not? And further advances in electrical grids. We should also note too that the interstate highway system facilitated travel, and once people experienced the warm weather, Sky, why did you look back at Paul? Do you like the interstate highway system? Do you have a mutual? Some friendships are built on shared interests. Most are. Most of those shared interests include movies, books, politics, vision, religion, but not Paul and Sky's. Paul and Sky's is all about the Eisenhower Expressway, the Stevenson, and who could forget I-88. Right? And the surrounding suburbs. All right, you're boring. Get out of here. It's scary. Oh, here we go. He's going to continue. There you go. And thus you have a reason to watch Cars, the Disney thing, Cars, right? See you later.
The Moab has a shelf life of 15 years.